Join me in the book of Exodus, chapter number 1. We're going to start, just for review purposes, at verse number 8. I took you very hurriedly through the changes in Egypt during the 1700s, 1600s, and the beginning of the 1500s B.C. That in a nutshell, we basically have the full-blood Egyptians lose control of Lower Egypt. That's Northern Egypt. That's the Delta area. They lose control of it to non-Egyptians, Semites. Semites similar to the Israelis, but not the same as the Israelis. During that time period, the Israelis are just having lots and lots of kids, growing their families exponentially. And at some point, possibly during the time of the Hyksos, that is the foreign rulers of Egypt, the non-Egyptian rulers of Egypt, somebody mentioned just how dangerous it was to have the Israelis so populous, but not part of their group. And so the Israelis were turned into slave labor. We know that in the early 1500s, the pure-blood Egyptians, who were kind of confined in southern Egypt, were kind of angry that they'd lost their properties down in the Delta. And so in 1570 BC, a man by the name of Amos the First, by that name, pushed southward along the Nile and engaged these foreign rulers of northern Egypt, broke them, defeated them, and ran them out and seized control of all of Egypt for Egyptians. And it is almost certain that he would have had an attitude of xenophobia, fear of strangers, or better for our understanding, fear of those not like us, in this case, Egyptians. And if the Israelis hadn't already been enslaved, Amos would have certainly have taking them into slavery. But there is a fear, even with them enslaved, that there's too many of them. And so we're pretty certain that Amos, and that's spelled A-H-M-O-S-E, if that helps you look him up for your own purposes, we're almost positive he is coming into part of the story here in Exodus chapter 1. And I'll point that out as we get closer. But here's the quick summary. Exodus 1:8, now there arose a new king over Egypt who didn't know Joseph. So he didn't care, you know, that the great Israeli Joseph had saved the Egyptians. He said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many, they're too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom, Ramesses." Those are both in the general vicinity of Goshen. "But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And so the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So rather than tamping down this exponential population growth of the Israelis, being slaves resulted in them having even more kids. There was a population explosion. And that worried the Egyptians. And I think by now we are talking about the pure-blood Egyptians under Amos the First, who had taken back Egypt for Egyptians. And so these pure-blood Egyptians, who have a fear of non-Egyptians, verse 8:13, they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. So you have in Egypt something like what we had in the colonial and early American South, where somebody from a different ethnic background was turned into slaves, treated as if they were just cattle, and they were worked like animals. And if they didn't behave themselves, they were treated like disobedient animals. And so it's not a surprise to me that a lot of the southern slaves, the African slaves in the South, related to this story. They saw themselves in this story. Back to the text, verse number 15. Then the king of Egypt, and this time I really think we're talking about Amos, possibly his son Amenhotep. Amenhotep came to power in about 1546 BC. So it may be that he's much more likely to be the one that drives this next part of the story. So the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shifra, the other Pua. Now there's always this question, are these ladies Egyptians or are they Hebrews? And it seems as if they're probably Egyptians. So he said to them, when you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool. Now, in their day, they gave birth squatting on a little stool rather than laying down on any type of bedding. So when you see them on the birth stool, if it's a son, you're going to kill him. If it's a daughter, she can go ahead and live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. So this is the first order to annihilate all the baby Israelis that are boys, because they probably thought that they could control the females a lot more easily. But these midwives refused to do it. It's just wrong. And so the king of Egypt called the midwives, said to them, why have you done this and let the male children live? And the midwives said to Pharaoh, it's because the Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They're vigorous and they give birth before the midwife comes to them. So God dealt well with midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very strong. So God blessed these midwives because they refused to follow the instructions of the Pharaoh, which were immoral, to kill off the baby boys. Verse 21 says, and because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. And the implication seems to be as if they had families inside Israel. And so either they were Egyptian ladies who got adopted into Israel, or they were Israeli ladies who were blessed inside of Israel because they'd stood up for the right thing. Now, verse 22. And this is the one that almost certainly is going to be Amenhotep the first, because he came to power in 1546, and the story we're about to read happens in 1536. So Pharaoh eventually commanded all his people, every son that is born to the Hebrews, you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. So the solution is there is going to be an act of worship required from the Israelites. They must feed all the baby boys to the god of the Nile. They gotta, if the baby born to them is a boy, they have to toss it into the water and let the crocodiles eat it. Now, the implication, sadly, is that some of the Israelis complied. Perhaps even many of the Israelis complied. But we follow the story of one particular family that refused to comply with this order. Verse 1 of chapter 2. Now, a man from the house of Lewi, or Levi, his name is Amram, we'll find out later, went and took as his wife a Levite woman. And it's Jochebed is her name, Jochebed. So they get married, and they start having kids. We know they had a daughter who is named Miriam, and she's probably the eldest. Then they had a son named Aaron. His birth happened before this order came. And so now a third pregnancy occurs. Verse 2, the woman conceived and bore a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him 3 months. So she spends the 9 months pregnant. They have no ultrasounds back at this time, no tests in order to discover the gender of the baby. They have to wait until the day of the birth. And when this baby is born, she discovers he's a boy. Now, the law says that she is supposed to feed him to the Nile. She won't do it because there is something special about him. Book of Hebrews makes a big deal out of this. It gives the idea in some of our English texts that he was a beautiful child, but it has more of the idea of not what he looked like, but that there was something special about him. I think, this is my opinion, I think that there had been some sort of prophetic insight given to mom, maybe dad as well, that this boy was going to be special. And so there was no way in the world they were going to feed him to the crocodiles. So 3 months, they managed to hide him. Now remember, they are slaves, so they have to go and work on a regular basis. And so hiding a baby, an infant, for 3 months is a pretty amazing thing to be able to do. But they get 3 months in, and that's when they figure out this is not going to work anymore. So verse 3, when she could hide him no longer, she comes up with a plan. Now, I love this plan. And this is not accidental. This is all purposeful, I'm convinced. So she took for him a basket made of bulrushes. So the plants, the water plants, she takes them and weaves them into kind of a little boat, a little covered boat. Now, they already made big boats out of these rushes. And so making a little one is not that big of a deal. And then she daubed it with bitumen and pitch, so she makes it waterproof. So she is doing this to keep the baby safe in the waters of the Nile for a period of time. So she did all that. Then she put the child in it, and she placed it among the reeds by the riverbank. Now she picks a very specific place to do this. It's the place where the daughter of Pharaoh is known to come and bathe. Now, whether or not she's doing some sort of recreational swimming, whether or not she's doing some sort of hygiene, I doubt that one, or maybe she's doing some sort of worship ceremony, which, with the Nile being considered to be a god, that would not be out of the question. But whatever the reason is, she comes there on a regular enough basis that Jochebed knows she's coming there and places Moses' little bulrush floating cradle near where she's going to be. So she doesn't just let him float randomly and he lands right next to this woman. This was a plan. Now, verse 4, his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. So Miriam is the lookout to keep an eye on the little boat for the baby and make sure that the right person finds it. Because if another Israeli finds the baby, that's not going to help. It has to be someone from the Egyptian power base. That's the goal. Verse 5. Now, the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river while her young women walked beside the river. So she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her servant woman and said, and she took it. Now, when she opened it up, so it was closed up, you know, to keep the water out even more, she saw the child, and behold, the baby was crying. Not surprising. The baby's by itself, in a basket, floating around on the little shallows of this river among the reeds, and so that's probably a little bit of a scary prospect. So she took pity on him and said, oh, this is one of the Hebrews' children. So she knows the law. She's aware of it. And so she feels sorry for this baby boy. And she immediately becomes attached to Moses. And that was the plan all along. Now, we don't know who this woman is. We know that, like I said, the Pharaoh of this time is Amenhotep the first. And there is going to be a female by the name of Hatshepsut that is a daughter of Pharaoh that comes up into power later. I doubt that it is her. I'm guessing that this is some unknown to history, daughter of the Pharaoh. And she, in her pity, wants to keep the child for her own. And so it is at this moment then that Miriam jumps forward. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you? And so she's like, hey, do you need a wet nurse to help you raise the baby? And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, go. Yeah, go get one. And so the girl went and called the child's mother. And so this is how Moses ends up being raised by his biological mother and being paid for it by his adopted Egyptian mother. And so he is a man of two worlds from the very beginning. This probably changed the status a little bit of Moses' biological family so that they ended up not working in the field, not working on construction projects, but rather working in and around the palace. And so the Pharaoh's daughter said to Jochebed, Moses' biological mother, take this child away, nurse him for me, I'll give you wages. So the woman took the child and nursed him. And when the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter. So apparently, at the very beginning, there's not as much contact with Pharaoh's daughter. You know, kind of want to wait until he becomes a little bit more fun. maybe she had a little bit of contact with him as an infant from time to time. But, you know, she was probably waiting for him to be potty trained and walking and able to do some basic talking before she wanted to, you know, engage him on a much more day-by-day basis. Because then she would train him to be part of the Egyptian court as his, as her adopted son. So when the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moshe, because she said, I drew him out of the water. Now that's very close to the Hebrew word for to draw out. Now we know that there is an Egyptian word, mensis, that is similar in sound and meaning. Because remember, Ramesses, that mensis part at the messis part at the end means to flow out or to draw forth. And so I'm guessing that this unnamed daughter of Pharaoh decided to give the baby a Hebrew name and probably asked, what's you guys' word for being drawn out of water? And when she was told that it sounded like Moshe, that may have been close enough to some of the Egyptian names, like, for example, Amose, the founder of this 15th dynasty, that she felt very comfortable giving him this name. And so this is how Moses became the man of two worlds. Now, before we get to verse number 11, when he is 40 years old, I want to kind of tell you a story that is found in the writings of Josephus about Moses. And it is part of the story of the Egyptian kingdom. The Egyptians had border disputes with a neighbor to the south. This would be Ethiopia. And this really got bad when Moses was about in his 20s. According to the Jewish tradition that Josephus is telling us, Moses had already been inducted as an officer into the chariot corps of the Egyptian army. And he had distinguished himself as a young officer. And so when the Pharaoh decided that the Ethiopians needed to pay a penalty for the border disputes going on, he dispatched Moses and his charioteers to go take care of this. Now, Josephus tells a lot more of the story. He tells about how Moses decided not to take the long way around, but instead to go straight through a really bad, desolate stretch of desert between Egypt and Ethiopia, and that this place was overrun with venomous serpents. Moses was smart enough to take a whole bunch of I think it was egrets or some other bird that was common to the, maybe an ibis with him, a whole bunch of them in baskets. And he let them loose at just the right time to eat up a whole bunch of these poisonous snakes. This is a very interesting story. You should look it up. But anyway, once he got to Ethiopia, he fought against them with such intensity and such strategy that the Ethiopians felt the need to surrender. And as part of the surrender treaty, the Cushites, I think they are the ones that requested that one of their princesses be married to Moses. And according to Josephus, Moses agreed that that is how the peace would be secured, by him as a prince of Egypt marrying a princess of the Cushites. And interestingly enough, in later stories, we hear about how Moses is married to a Cushite woman. And that can't possibly be his Midianite wife, because the Midianites were not Cushites. And so when we get to that story later, I'll hearken back to this story here. All right, so to set the story up for next time, Moses spends 40 years of his life being Egyptian. And he apparently excels in the military and excels in the royal court, but he always has something there in his heart about being an Israeli. And it breaks his heart to see how his ethnic relatives are constantly being abused. And in the story we tell next, that comes to a great big crisis point.